How did the Gilded Age lead into the Progressive Era? Pulitzer Prize-winning author Doris Kearns Goodwin joins us to talk about her new book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism.
When you're trying to create the texture of a time, and this is a time, the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era, if you get a series of characters coming at it from a different point of view, each of their stories together makes up the larger story of the Progressive Era.
Can economists predict a financial crisis? Greg Mankiw, a professor of economics at Harvard, talks about Alan Greenspan's new book, The Map and the Territory, which he reviews in this week's issue.
I think he points to animal spirits and human psychology and our inability to forecast it. And also, I think he acknowledges that the financial institutions just screwed up big time, and he does call for higher capital requirements.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is here to talk about her new book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Doris, thank you so much for coming in.
I'm delighted to be here.
So it's interesting when you look at this book and the book that you obviously did about Lincoln, Team of Rivals, and your book about FDR, No Ordinary Time, and Eleanor Roosevelt, they all seem to be about relationships and really about the dynamic between these great figures as opposed to a simple biography, one-person biography. Is that deliberate?
Yes. I mean, I think the reason is because I know I'm going to live with my figures for such a long period of time, I've tended to choose the most interesting people to live with. So if it's FDR or Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt. And yet, if you're going to write a straight biography, that's really hard because so many other good people have come before you. So I widen the cast of characters in order to hopefully give a fresh look at my guy. But then also, I think you learn more about a person when you see how they relate to the inner circle, in Lincoln's case, to their families, or to their rivals or friends, as in this case. You get a sense of strengths and weaknesses, and I love relationships. I mean, I think that's what life is about, and I'd rather do that than just have the guy out there making policy.
It also gives you kind of a broader view of how they act in their own worlds.
No, that's exactly right. And when you're trying to create the texture of a time, and this is a time, the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era, if you get a series of characters coming at it from a different point of view, each of their stories together makes up the larger story of the Progressive Era. So you've got one woman who's domestic, you've got another woman who's becoming sure she'll never marry Ida Tarbell because she wants to have a career, another one that chooses Taft because she feels she can have her ambitions through him, unlike Edith Roosevelt. And then you get the journalists who are coming at the Progressive Era from a different point of view. So taken together, when you think about what history is a series of stories that make up a larger story of a decade or a century or whatever, and it's their stories I wanted to tell.
It's also, and I'm sure it's not just luck, but in part deliberate, the relationships that you look at are very dynamic ones. These are not cases where, you know, the marriage sort of was very constant or the relationship that Lincoln had with his cabinet members was always amicable. You really have that with Roosevelt and Taft, who went through some serious ups and downs.
I think that's right. I mean, when you can explore a relationship that had a lot of different phases to it, and often that's true of life too. And in this case, starting out as such good friends, even though they were always opposites. I mean, when I think of them together with Taft walking slowly and Teddy running at a great speed wherever they went, and Teddy saying of Taft that you have the most wonderful personality. People love you at first sight. Things are a little slower with me. Taft being a procrastinator, Teddy preparing everything ahead of time. And yet they were allies because when they were young, they were both reformers against the corruption of the age. But then, of course, they become even closer when Taft gets into Teddy's cabinet, is the most important person in his cabinet, handpicked by Teddy to be his successor. And then, however, when Teddy comes back from Africa feeling Taft has betrayed his progressive legacy, it's much more complicated than that, but nonetheless ends up running against him. And then that friendship that had been so strong not only breaks apart politically, but heartbreakingly emotionally as well.
They do reconcile, though, in the end.
Am I giving away the ending?
No, it's fine. I mean, it's interesting. When I ended the book, and I knew it was going to end in 1912, because that's when the Republican progressive era ends, and yet I just decided to follow them, hoping that something would happen. So the first couple years of following them were discouraging, because they would meet and nothing happened. It was like an armed neutrality. But then finally, when I got up to 1918, and it turned out that Taft had come to the Blackstone Hotel in Chicago and was going up in an elevator, and he was told by the elevator operator, Roosevelt's in the dining room eating alone. And he went downstairs. 100 people are in the dining room. Luckily, a reporter is there. This is one of those moments you just want captured. So it's not a story told by a story told by a story. And he goes over to Teddy, and they do embrace at this point. Enough time has gone by. Sit down together, and the entire audience of diners and waitstaff erupts in applause. So it was such a happy way to end the book. I always look for that. When I was sad about Lincoln dying at the end, I was able to find a Tolstoy quote that talked about the fact he'd just come back from Chechnya, and a group of wild barbarians had asked him to talk about Lincoln. And since Lincoln dreamed of being remembered all his life, I could at least allow that dream to be realized in the last pages of the book. Since I don't even want to ever think of them dying, they still live in my mind.
And it's appropriate that that happy moment in this story comes from a member of the press, because the press, of course, is a large part of the story you're telling. So it's not just a story of these two presidents, but also of the press and their relationship with the press.
Oh, no question. In fact, that's probably a third of the story. I mean, once I realized that Roosevelt's success as a leader came because he understood the bully pulpit, thus the title of the book, which means using the presidential platform to reach the public, to educate them, you need the press to do that. And he had the most remarkable set of relationships with the press of any president I've ever studied. He let them come in for breakfast, lunch, and dinner during the barber's hour. But most importantly, he became really close to a group at McClure's magazine, which was the most progressive, influential magazine of the decade. And the journalists there are still legendary: Ida Tarbell, Ray Baker, William Allen White, and Lincoln Steffens. And what he was able to do was he would get the proofs of their articles ahead of time. He would sometimes send proofs of his speeches and his messages to them. But neither side lost their integrity, because they could still continue to criticize him, which they did.
Right.
And he could still argue with them. You don't understand practical politics. You're too idealistic. And they all became incredibly interesting characters in my mind. And that's why I termed it the golden age of journalism. It didn't mean in general, because there were tabloid press there as well. But for this group of people, they knew they had a mission and a call. And their stories, whether it was Ida Tarbell's Standard Oil story or Ray Baker's railroad story or William Allen White's stories or Lincoln Steffens' corruption stories, changed public opinion. And they knew they had made a difference in their time. And years later, they look back, too, with nostalgia on this era when journalism was really in the forefront of change.
I don't know, again, if you have some kind of golden lens into the future, but with Team of Rivals, of course, it came out and there was Obama and everybody was drawing comparisons between the two presidents. And this is coming out and is really kind of describing a similar setting to our current era, at least in terms of a gilded age. We don't quite have the progressive era yet, but I wonder if, did you see those parallels as you were writing? Did it just kind of happen that way?
I wish I could say I saw them. I think what the truth is that these books take so long that by the time I finish, something has circled back. Certainly when I started Lincoln, I had little idea of who Obama was, much less that he would bring Hillary into the cabinet, creating what they then saw as a team of rivals, or read the book and talk about taking it to a desert island. And in this case, obviously there was a sense of a growing gap a little bit when I started the book 7 years ago, but it's become much more understood by the public at large after the Occupy Wall Street movement and after the middle class feels squeezed out. But even more importantly, what I think combines the two eras is what created the gap between the rich and the poor, and the feeling that workers weren't being treated correctly in the industrial age, was all the new inventions of the industrial age had created these huge millionaires and the new mergers and companies. Now we have the technological digital age. producing once again this sliver of incredibly wealthy people and the rest of the people not doing so well. So it does really have resonance. And it makes it more fun because you've got to believe as an historian that looking back to the past can help you to figure out what might be possible. And you're right. There is no progressive era now that's following the Gilded Age. And that progressive era softened the aspects of industrialization and really made things better for the people living at that time because the journalists cared about it, the political leaders cared about it, and the public got absolutely mobilized to want to do something about it.
All right. Well, we've got the Gilded Age part down now. We just need to cue the new progressive era and another golden age of journalism, and then we can declare you a prophet. Thank you so much, Doris, for coming in.
You are more than welcome.
The book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital by Mark Leibovich. That's This Town by Mark Leibovich, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. Julie, hi.
Hi, Pamela.
So there's some breaking news.
Definitely. This is a case that I never thought I would see the end of, but Judge Jenny Chin has just ruled on Thursday that the Google Books case is now been resolved, and he dismissed this lawsuit, which was originally filed in 2005 by the Authors Guild and Publishers Group, accusing Google of violating copyright by engaging in a massive book scanning project.
Okay, let's scroll back in time for people who perhaps didn't even know what Google was in 2005. What was the original case?
So this was back in 2005. Ed Wyatt was the publishing reporter for the New York Times, just to take you back. And the original case accused Google of taking books, which Google acknowledged that it had done, and scanning them digitally and posting snippets of these books online. Now, the Authors Guild and the Association of American Publishers said that this was a violation of copyright, that Google had no right to take books that did not belong to them and scan them, no matter what the purpose was. So,
and what was Google's argument here? What was their position?
Google's
information
argument.
Information wants to be free.
Yeah, I mean, Google claimed from the beginning that it was in the right, that it was only posting small portions of these books.
So that it fell under fair use.
Yes, and then 2 years later, Google and the Authors Guild and the Publishers Group came to an agreement to settle the case for $125 million.
Pennies in the online world.
Pennies. Google just, you know, rattled around in its pockets and found a nickel. So it was really not much money. But Judge Chin, who's been overlooking this case for a very long time, rejected the settlement in 2011, which then threw the case back into limbo. So now here we are 2 years later. Judge Chin has been hearing arguments on fair use, and that was his eventual decision, which he laid out today. He said in a pretty amazing statement in his opinion, he said that this project actually provides significant public benefits, that it advances the progress of the arts and sciences. It preserves books, in particular out of print and old books that, in his words, have been forgotten in the bowels of libraries, and it gives them new life. He said that the Google Books Project facilitates access to books for print disabled and remote or underserved populations, and that indeed all society benefits from this project. So
I'm a little stung about that bowels of libraries phrase.
And, you know, for researchers, for academics, this is a huge win because anyone who's tried to find an obscure book who's doing research has been thrilled by Google Books. You don't have to, you know, fly to a research library or try to find a sympathetic librarian to find something for you. It's just online. Judge Chin seems to buy Google's argument that this is something that really benefits anyone who wants to access books and that it did not harm authors. He wrote in his opinion that no one was stitching together snippets of books online and publishing them or reading them or doing any of the things that the Authors Guild said that it feared would happen.
So who loses? I mean, this all sounds, it sounds like a big win for, as you said, researchers, academics, readers. Who loses?
Well, the Authors Guild, who devoted 8 years and a lot of money into, you know, fighting Google. It's a lot of legal fees.
And what about the authors?
Well, the Authors Guild, I had an interview with Paul Aiken, the executive director of the Authors Guild today, and he said that he expects to appeal the result, that obviously they disagree with the decision, and that they still believe that Google created unauthorized digital versions of most of the world's copy-protected books, and that this has extended far beyond just U.S. authors. I spoke to another legal expert, James Grimmelman, of the University of Maryland, who's really been the person who's been following this case from the beginning and has become a real expert on it. He said that so much time has now passed since the lawsuit was originally filed that the whole issue of digital scanning has diminished so much in importance. You know, when this lawsuit was filed in 2005, you know, there really were not e-books and no one had a Kindle. It seemed like a dramatic and sort of scary thing that books were being digitally scanned and distributed. But now book scanning has gone from an exciting novelty to part of the background of the industry, as Grimmelman said. He said that it's been going on for so long now that it's just part of the business.
All right. Well, sounds like it might be back to the bowels of the courtroom.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, Thule.
Thanks.
Greg Mankiw joins us now to talk about his review of Alan Greenspan's book, The Map and the Territory, Risk, Human Nature, and the Future of Forecasting, which he reviews in this week's issue. Greg, thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be with you.
So this book, you note, this is not a memoir, a personal narrative of the recession or the period after, but really a work of economics that's sort of half written for an academic audience.
That's right. I mean, Alan Greenspan wrote a memoir a few years ago, The Age of Turbulence. Ironically, wasn't really the age of turbulence. That was still yet to come. And now, after going through the financial crisis, he's now revising his views on how the economy works.
How have his views changed?
No, nobody throws out their worldview completely. And you see a lot of the old Alan Greenspan in this book. But there is a new Alan Greenspan as well. He gives a lot more weight to psychology, to irrational animal spirits, a phrase that he borrows from John Maynard Keynes. And he's more skeptical about the ability of financial institutions to make rational decisions in response to these periods of euphoria that they go through.
Well, that's actually a pretty remarkable shift for him.
It is. He's always been a big believer in markets as opposed to governments. And that still comes through in a big way in this book. He's still a deep skeptic about governments, but he's also has a little more of a jaundiced eye about the efficiency of markets.
And is this a result of the financial crisis and its aftermath?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he points to the financial crisis and his own shock at how badly financial institutions managed their own risk portfolios.
Does he see that, the book is about forecasting. Does he see that there was a problem that that economists didn't recognize what was going on?
Well, I think economists have never been good at forecasting, and I think he notes that. Economists are often turned to because the public thinks of us as astrologers. We somehow can see the future.
But right, you're supposed to tell us exactly what would happen.
I know. Well, we'd like to be able to do that, but we're really very bad at it, and especially dramatic events are almost never predictable. And this goes back even to the Great Depression, where a lot of economists are caught flat-footed. And the truth is, despite 50 years of advanced statistical work in economics, we're not much better at forecasting major changes in the economy than we were in the 1930s.
But this then is an effort to perhaps explain why the forecasting didn't work.
Yes, and the limits of forecasting. I think Greenspan would say, look, because of the psychology of human nature, because people do go through these waves of euphoria and depression, alternating between greed and fear, that it's very hard to predict which way the economy is going to go.
One of the things that you point out in your review is that Greenspan has a different trajectory from a lot of other economists who went through academia and then into government. How is it different?
Almost all the economists that you read about in the newspaper today, people like Janet Yellen or Ben Bernanke or Larry Summers, they started out off as academics, and they had a long academic track record where they went through the university system, got their PhD, spend years toiling in academia, writing articles for other economists to impress their peers, and before they're getting tenure somewhere. Alan Greenspan didn't do that. He sort of left school without his PhD. He got his PhD many years later. He didn't work in academia. He worked in the private sector, and he became famous not through his academic writings, as was true, say, with Ben Bernanke or Larry Summers, but rather as a political figure, where he advised politicians. Gerald Ford, and then he was later appointed by Ronald Reagan to the Federal Reserve. So he really became a famous economist through the political process, as opposed to becoming a famous economist by being first famous among economists.
And how do you think that changed his approach then once he was in power?
Well, I think because he was a business economist, he was used to talking to non-economists. Most people come from academia, spend all their time talking to other economists. Alan Greenspan knew how to talk to non-economists. I think he was probably better at talking to politicians initially, because he was used to doing sort of business kind of presentations. He comes to the world with, I think, less of an emphasis on theory and more of an emphasis on business experience and a deep, deep knowledge of the data. He knows the data backwards and forwards, much more so than most academics do.
Has he been suspicious of the approach of those economists who rose through the ranks of academia?
I don't know if he's suspicious of the individuals, but I do get the sense he's suspicious of the models that academics are fond of. I mean, one of the things academics do is to develop models or theories of how the economy works and spend lots of time trying to refine those theories. My sense is that Greenspan is generally suspicious that those models capture reality, and he's much more interested in diving into the details of the data and seeing what the data has to tell us in a relatively theory-free way.
But this book is a lot of, if not theory, it's certainly a lot of data, right?
There's a lot of data. And he, I won't say he doesn't have a theoretical perspective. He does have a perspective, but he doesn't write down equations and do the kind of sort of mathematical modeling that academic economists do.
I think a lot of lay readers will want to go into a book like this and say, okay, what happened? What went wrong? Does Greenspan come up with an answer to that question?
I think he points to animal spirits and human psychology and our inability to forecast it. And also, I think he acknowledges that the financial institutions just screwed up big time. And he does call for higher capital requirements, meaning, yeah, I need a larger buffer if you're going to run a financial institution, so that when you start losing money, you don't end up in the insolvent region quite so quickly.
Now, you are obviously coming at this from the perspective of both an economist and an academic economist. What for you was the most interesting insight in the book?
Well, the interesting thing to me is that he really tries to lay out his whole worldview. It's not like there's sort of one thing. He covers a lot of terrain.
I guess that's why it's called the map and the territory.
Well, exactly. And he's really giving you his whole sort of view. You get a sense that this person spent his whole life being an economist in business and policy. And he really wants to say, okay, now that I'm at the tail end of my career, I want to sort of lay out the best I can how I view the world. And so it wasn't like this one big insight, but it's really trying to lay out a whole worldview. And to me, this is really quite fascinating, because he's had a perspective on this that very few people have had. I mean, he was in that job as Fed chair for 18 years.
Right.
And there's nothing better in terms of learning about the world than having a staff of, I don't know, several hundred Fed economists whose main job is to make sure you know what you're doing, teaching you every day for 18 years. You're going to come away with some knowledge of how the economy works. So I think that whole worldview is really quite fascinating.
But not, alas, with the ability to predict the next financial crisis.
No, we're not going to be able to predict well. And I think anybody who turns to economists for accurate predictions is going to be disappointed.
Dismally disappointed.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
The book, again, is The Map and the Territory, Risk, Human Nature, and the Future of Forecasting by Alan Greenspan, reviewed by Greg Mankiw in this week's issue. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
I'm going to take a look at the hardcover list. On the fiction side of things, there are just four new titles. All fairly high on the list, starting at number two. Clive Cussler has a new nautical adventure called Mirage, co-written with Jack DuBrule. That's new at number two. Then at number four, Amy Tan is back on the list with a novel called The Valley of Amazement. She, of course, broke through big with The Joyluck Club, which was a mother-daughter novel. And this Valley of Amazement is also about mother and daughter through the years. Then new at number five, Alexander McCall Smith continues his Ladies Detective Agency series with a new book called The Minor Adjustment Beauty Salon. That's the 14th installment in that series, and it's new on the list at number five. And then the last new title on the hardcover fiction list this week is at number six. Fanny Flagg, the author of Fried Green Tomatoes and other kind of down-home southern domestic novels.
Back to the early 90s here with these books.
She is back on the list with a book called The All-Girl Filling Station's Last Reunion. And it's kind of a historical novel. It goes back to World War II and looks at a gas station that was run entirely by women. That's new on the list at number six. Over on the nonfiction side of things, also a quiet week this week. There's just three new titles. The highest ranking new title in nonfiction is Mark Halperin and John Heilman's Double Down. That is their look going back at the 2012 election.
That was reviewed on our cover last week.
Memorably so.
Michael Kinsley.
Yes.
And then we've also got this week's cover review.
Yeah, that's right. New at number four, Doris Kearns Goodwin, who was also a podcast guest this week. Her book, The Bully Pulpit, which reviewed on our cover by Bill Keller, is new on the list at number four. And that, of course, goes back and looks at Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft and the muckraking era, the whole progressive era. And then finally, the last new title on the hardcover nonfiction list this week is at number eight. It's by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager. It's called George Washington's Secret Six. It's another work of history. It goes back to the Revolution, of course, George Washington, looking at espionage during the Revolutionary War. The Culper spy ring, six spies who helped the American cause.
All right, Greg, thanks so much.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.